Previously on Slim and None.
My name is John Coburn, from Needham, Massachusetts originally, now in sunny Florida, and still working. Together with Howard Baldwin, we started the New England Whalers.
To operate a hockey franchise, you need capital, players, a staff, and an arena. But just a year and a half prior to the puck dropping on the Whalers' first game, the 20-somethings had none of the above. In fact, at the time, they were living out in Cape Cod, operating a clothing store.
I just felt something was going to happen and something good would happen. And fortunately, it did.
After reading about the upstart hockey league in the Boston Globe, the duo met with Gary Davidson and Dennis Murphy, the league's founders.
He said the criteria for getting in was proper financial backing, obviously an arena, and the initial franchise fee of $25,000, which really went to Don and Gary and Dennis, and $10,000 for league dues. That was it. That's what we needed.
It was 1971, and the next league meetings were scheduled for just over a month later down in Miami. Come October, the group decided to make the trek to Miami, despite not having all the details of their plan ironed out. The pitch they presented to Dennis and Gary was testament to the fact that sometimes, when you have nothing to lose, you can achieve great success.
They told us, good news, you got the franchise. And then they looked at us and said, but we've changed the price from 25 grand to 250 grand. We just looked at each other and laughed and said, look, we don't have the money anyway, so why don't we just say yeah?
The Miami trip was a success. The boys had arrived with nothing and were returning home for the franchise. It wasn't until a few days later, now back at his local diner in Boston, when Howard truly realized what he and Johnny were getting themselves into.
And I'm sitting there having my coffee and people are yakking away and I see this guy in the corner reading the Boston Herald.
Clear as day, the headline read,
new franchise comes to Boston. These two kids have two chances, Slim and None. And it was a real shock. I wouldn't kid you, because I realized right then and there that we couldn't, you know, be so loosey-goosey. I mean, we were now, our asses were on the line.
There was no shortage of tasks to complete, and the clock was ticking.
And really now turn to and do everything we said we were going to do, which is to raise a significant amount of money and get a hockey general manager, a place to play. I mean, keep in mind, November, this was November 1971. So we had 10 months to put a team together, get a place to play, raise a couple of million bucks, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So somewhat of a daunting task. And if you break it down into parts, the first challenge or simultaneous challenge really was all three of those.
Finding a general manager and a place to play took a back seat to the first order of business, securing proper financial backing.
Then Godfrey Wood was charged with getting us some money. And that got underway very quickly. I mean, I think, gosh, within 2 or 3 weeks, we had a meeting with Bob Schmertz.
My name's Godfrey Wood. I was classmates and best friends and still are with John Coburn. And after we graduated, John went to work with Howard in a clothing store, if you can believe that, in Cape Cod, which never struck me as a good place to be in the winter. And I went down to New York to seek my millions. And John and I kept track of each other. And one day I got a message from him that he and Howard were thinking of starting a new pro hockey league and team. And would I be interested? And the rest is history or not, depending on your point of view.
Because they shared that spirit of adventure, Johnny, Howard and Godfrey got along famously.
Now they were ambitious young men, as I was, and none of us had any substantial capital. So you always go and try to find somebody else's money and make sure you're fair to them and that you get your share of it. I figured the easiest way was from one person.
Frankly, we were lucky. We were lucky that we found the investor that Godfrey brought us. One person, that's all we had to really speak to.
And frankly, it was a very easy process. His name was Bob Schmertz. He had a company called Leisure Technology that was based in New Jersey. He built a retirement community and was very thoughtful. He had extra wide sidewalks and things like that for people to accommodate their unique needs. And I had met him through my boss, who was a guy named Sandy Weil, who has gone on to great fame and fortune. And he was actually a client of Sandy's. So we kind of talked about that. And Sandy ended up with 1% of the New England Whalers.
Sandy was another guy that had 1% of the Whalers. Now, Sandy, big time guy. He ended up being chairman of the board of American Express, chairman of the board of Travelers. I mean, you look up Sandy Weil and you'll see there's a big shooter. But at the time, he was becoming a big shooter. So he introduced us with Woody to Schmertz.
He said, yeah, I'd like to do the deal. And we negotiated a little bit about how much he would get and how much we would keep. And we were off to the races. He was a great partner. Just left us alone, left Howard and John alone to run the business and held them accountable for stuff. But he knew it was an adventure, not necessarily another major financial gain.
And even from their very first meeting, what an adventure it was.
That's the famous meeting on the tarmac of the, you know, at New Bedford Airport where we're waiting for him, and he landed in the wrong airport. And then we pick him up at New Bedford. He finally found the right airport. We put him in the back of Coburn's Jeep, or in the front seat. I sat in the back, and we go to the attorney's office, you know, and we were in the room with him, the boardroom in the legal office in New Bedford. And he said, I'll put it in, but I won't put it all in capital. I'll put 500 grand. In capital, and I'll give you a line of credit for $1 million.
I guess to him it was nothing. We said we'd have to leave the room and discuss it. We got out in the hall and said, oh my God. Then we came back in and said, well, consider this after my minute. We came back in and said, okay, we'll go for it. I mean, really, it was, as I say, we were lucky. Yeah, I mean, we had put up
there,
nothing.
There you go. But it happened so quick. We had one meeting with him, and that was that. We got back in the car. In fact, the back door opened. I almost fell out onto the highway. And Schmertz's lawyer said, don't worry, let him go. We haven't made the deal yet. His lawyer was a prick. And that was the beginning of the relationship with Bob Schmertz, which was a wonderful relationship. So we became a much more powerful entity because of that.
The stability that Schmertz lended to the Whalers can't be overstated.
And then in the Hall of Fame, if I didn't do that the way I did, he wouldn't have gotten in. Because when I left the Whalers, they wanted to put me in the first year, and I said no. I said, I'll go the second year, but only if Bob Schmertz is put into the Hall of Fame. But those guys in Hartford and you know, in 1988, they didn't have really any knowledge or the things that Bob had done. But I knew what he had done. I knew we had nothing without him.
The money was secured, but there were no shortage of question marks that remained. You need 23 players to fill a hockey roster. Perhaps even more importantly, though, you need someone spectacular to lead them. To guide the team in their inaugural season, the boys first approached an established name with a long track record of success in the NHL.
We thought about Harry Sinden, that he would be a good coach and GM.
Harry was a very powerful figure then, and he coached the Bruins to their Stanley Cup. That famous picture of Bobby Orr diving across the St. Louis, remember? And so he was a huge figure there, and then he had a falling out. So I made one phone call to him, and he said, sure, I'll meet with you guys, you know, because he was mad at Boston. He was mad at the Bruins. And so Kobe and I flew to Toronto. We met him at the Westbury Hotel, which actually my uncle owned, so it was kind of cool. And had a good meeting with him and left it that we'd be in touch.
There would be no second meeting.
I don't know whether the Bruins got wind of the fact that we met. I don't really know, but very shortly thereafter, they brought him back to be the GM. I mean, very shortly thereafter.
Though it's unlikely Harry would have taken the job anyway.
I mean, why would he go with that? I mean, these kids who hadn't played a game, didn't have a place to play, didn't have a players. So he turned us down.
Knowing that Harry was no longer an option, the boys looked elsewhere.
And I suggested to Howard, how about that guy you told me about, Jack Kelly? He said, that's a good idea. So sure enough, we got him. We met with him. We hit it off with him. Jack Kelly was the coach of the Boston University Terriers. And they just won the national championship that year, which was a big deal.
In the championship game against Cornell, Boston University is the defending champion. The Terriers won the crown by beating Wisconsin last year in Syracuse. For Boston University coach Jack Kelly, his swan song. Kelly is retiring from college coaching after this game and wants two in a row. Only a few seconds remaining. Boston University will win its second straight national collegiate championship. Something no other Eastern team has ever done. It's also a great victory for Coach Jack Kelly, who ends his collegiate coaching career with two national titles.
I knew Jack from, as you guys know, the BU days. And so that's why I reached out to Jack. Once we started discussions with Jack, we never had another conversation with Harry, just so you know. Never had another conversation. I mean, he's, you know, one of the iconic college hockey coaches is Jack Kelly. We liked Harry a lot, but we just wanted to maybe do something a little different.
Well, that was the WHA. Everybody took chances. You know, we didn't do things the standard way in the WHA. My name's Jack Ferrer. I've been in professional hockey 48 years, but I started 1972, inaugural season of the Whalers. It was the New England Whalers. At that time, they were out of Boston. And my former college coach, Jack Kelly, was named GM and coach of the Whalers.
Like Kelly, Ferreira, then a 20-something-year-old, had no professional experience to date. What Ferreira did have was a reputation as a brilliant hockey mind. And so it's no surprise that he was one of the first calls Kelly made after being offered the job.
So he contacted me. I was coaching at Brown University at the time. If I was interested to come and join him and do some scouting for him. I said, sure. You know, I haven't even gone home and said anything to my wife yet, but I said, yeah.
That they both played under Kelly when he was coach of the Terriers was something that Howard and Jack held in common.
Well, when I was a student, and I put that word in quotes, because I really didn't go to class much, but I did try out for the hockey team. And if you ask Jack, he said I was going to make it, but as like the last, like fourth line or fifth or sixth defenseman. And he was very good about it. And I was actually, I was a good hockey player at school, but I had missed too much time, you know, because of the Marines.
When it became apparent that a future playing collegiate hockey wasn't in the cards, Howard approached Kelly.
I went up. I figured I should go and look him in the eye and tell him that I'm going to pull myself out. And we had the most wonderful discussion. It was such a terrific discussion. And I went away from that discussion saying, there's a guy that cares about me and about people, and he's going to do great. And he did.
Though Howard didn't know it, what would become a long and storied relationship with Kelly was, at the time, only in its infancy.
I always remembered that. I met one more time with him in Bedford, New York. Jack had a hockey school there. Somehow we ended up at a lunch with some other people. And he has said, how are you doing? And this and that. And I said, well, I'm working for the Flyers, but one day I'm going to have a team. And he says, if you ever do, give me a call. And I did. And we clicked. We clicked right away.
That Kelly would leave the great thing he had going with the Terriers wasn't always a given.
When you're so firmly established in a solid career, in the case of Jack, he was firmly established as a great college coach. Now, in the NHL, they weren't hiring college coaches.
Then again, Kelly did things differently than everyone else coaching at the collegiate level.
And he was ahead of his years at Boston University. At that time, you know, it was very few films and all that stuff, but he always had what to do against the other team, no matter who we were playing. You know, he had a good scouting report on them. I think, and in being in Boston, he was such a well-known name that it was a natural for them to go after him.
Kelly's progressiveness and his New England roots were just two of many attributes which made him a prime candidate to lead the Whalers in their inaugural season.
He was terrific. He was straightforward. You always knew what he thought. Sort of like Howard. Howard was that way too. Jack was good with us.
He's a magnificent coach, did a beautiful job putting together the team together.
The players respected him.
And the one thing in pro hockey, you can't fool the players. They can see through you in a minute.
And he kept them off guard. He kept them guessing. He would do weird things, you know, that always had them sort of wondering where they stood. So it was one sort of a form of fear and keeping them on their toes.
He was tough. I mean, as far as a coach, he was always on you. But he always had a reason for why. He could get the best out of certain guys for being on him. Other guys pat him on the back. He was a master at that. And we all, you know, would go to hell's end for him, you know. He was just a good coach.
Terrific guy, intensely, really competitive, really competitive, and strict. We clashed a few times. I mean, I was intimidated by him. I wouldn't kid you. Because he did remind me of my drill instructors.
If there was one thing Kelly was used to, it was winning.
And if you kind of reach the top of the mountain in college, as Jack did, you're looking for the next challenge.
And what could be a bigger challenge than leading the upstart Whalers? When the chance presented itself, Kelly couldn't say no. Yet, even still.
But it took a great leap of faith. A real, real leap of faith.
No one saw it as big a leap as Jenny did, Jack Kelly's wife.
Jenny, the first time I met Jenny was at a dinner for Jack and in a banquet they had for him because he was leaving. I think it was in February. And she leaned over to me and said, Howard Baldwin, you better know what the hell you're doing taking my husband away from security. And I gulped and said, oh my God, just another reason to be fearful.
Once he was on board, Kelly got right to work assembling the rest of his staff. Ron Ryan, who had played under Kelly when he coached at Colby, was brought on as assistant GM.
And that was one of the first hires that Jack made. And a great sort of alter ego to Jack, because Ronnie could really talk the lingo of the players, because most of those players wouldn't know who the hell Ronnie was as a college player. And he was a Canadian boy.
Bob Crocker, then the freshman coach at BU, came on to serve as an assistant. Jack Ferreira, Kelly's chief scout, rounded out the staff.
I get in there and I was basically a scouting staff of one. So it gave me an opportunity to do so much and learn on the job. I just loved it. I can't believe how much it helped me in my further years. I liked the scouting. I liked to be independent. I liked to be the one that was making the final decision, like we'll take A over B or whatever. I liked that. And throughout my whole career, I always wanted to be that guy.
Slowly but surely, the pieces were starting to fall into place. The boys had their money from Schmertz, and they had their leader in Kelly. And they were happy to leave the hockey guys to run the hockey side of the operation and fill out the roster. After all, Howard and Johnny had their own fish to fry. There was that oh-so-small issue of figuring out where exactly home games were going to be played. And no one could have anticipated what an escapade that would be.